The views expressed on the following broadcasts do not necessarily reflect those of KHLT, Take 12 Radio, or our affiliates. The opinions on this show should not be considered as medical, psychological, or professional advice and are those of the host, co-host, and guest. Take 12 Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting are not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
One day at a time with its failures and fears. Portion of pain and burden of care, we must meet.
Welcome to Walking Through the Language of the Heart, a journey into the grapevine writings of Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill W. And now, here are your co-hosts, Chris S. and the Monty Man.
Well, greetings one and all. Hello, family. Welcome aboard to Walking Through the Language of the Heart with myself and Chris S. as we literally walk through... Well, I guess I can't say literally. That'd be a little weird. As we figuratively walk through every chapter, every sentence of this wonderful book, The Language of the Heart, Bill W.'s Grapevine Writings from 1944 to 1970. I almost said 1950. We're in 1950s now, I believe. Welcome, Chris, once again to the show. You know, I was thinking about you when we get done with this, we've done a lot of shows together, buddy.
Yeah, it'll be hundreds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been an absolute honor and pleasure. Thank you for sending me Charlie P's memorial service and funeral. Wow, lots of suits, lots of people dressing up in the AA style. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
That was probably the best funeral I've ever seen. You know, when you the speakers and how well it was done.
Right.
It was impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. What a great loss, but what a great legacy that he left us, you know? And isn't that what we're trying to do? We want to leave something behind that is going to be a maximum service to God and the people, right?
That's certainly a plus, and certainly Charlie left an enormous amount behind. He did workshops everywhere, and if anyone listening tonight is not familiar with Charlie's recovery talks or workshops, please track them down. You can find anything online today,
yeah,
and you can find a bunch of the things that he did.
Yeah, we will be posting several of them on our speakers page here in the next week or so, too. In fact, I was planning on doing that this week, but got wrapped up with remodel. Let's put it that way. All right. So this week, the article that Bill wrote is entitled "The Vision of Tomorrow." Send us forth there, Almighty One.
All right. So... January 1952. We're already in 1952. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
So this reminds me a little bit of A Vision for You, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
Monty?
Yes. Yes. The title. Yeah.
And A Vision for You in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is quite remarkable. It talks about a couple of visions. It talks about a vision of active alcoholism, and it talks about a vision of recovery, and it compares the two. You know, we really have to be convinced that it's going to be worth our while to do this stuff. And so Bill is one of the best people in the world at explaining just why we should do this. Why should we behave thusly? you know, and I have a feeling he's going to probably do a little bit of that, you know, tonight for us. But anyway, so let's go back to January 1952, the vision for tomorrow. clear vision for tomorrow comes only after a real look at yesterday. That's why we AAs take personal inventory. That's why this issue of the grapevine directs us to meditate upon the great happenings of 1951. It is our yearly inventory.
Oh.
Monty, have you been in any groups that do annual inventories?
I haven't been in any that do an annual inventory, but I've been in a couple that have. I've been in one that did an inventory and one that is in dire need still today of doing an inventory.
It never comes out well, you know. And a lot of times these groups are really falling short on carrying the message to the newcomer.
That's right.
And you find that out, and there's service commitments that are unfilled, and it's kind of a painful process. I've been part of many groups that have done that business inventory or group inventory, yeah, whatever you want to say, and usually it's a wake-up call that people stay asleep to.
So let me ask you this, because you've been involved in several and I've been involved in one. What was the atmosphere, one of humility, where people said, you know, gosh, yeah, we're going off the rails here, we really need to do this? Or was there, you know, were people fighting and having to be drugged through the thing?
You know, there was a general reluctance on most of the people's part to take the group inventory, kind of knowing ahead of time that it's not going to be pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a GSR usually is the one that was driving it. So you have to sometimes show the GSR the respect that they're due when they're tasked with something. And I was part of a group that did it annually out of a sense of obligation.
Wow.
And wasn't really being driven by any outside forces. So the one thing I don't know is where that inventory came from. I think it's a general service piece of writing, mm-hmm, but I can't really remember.
Hmm. Interesting.
Anyway, every AA will agree that we have just lived through an awesome destiny-shaping 12 months. The greatest event was, I think, AA's assumption of its third legacy of service. Our grown-up society could, for the first time, know its own mind, assume the guidance of its principal affairs, and guardianship of its traditions. The third legacy did mark, too, our definite abandonment of the petty squabbles of childhood for a far more mature statementship. I don't know how accurate that was. We're still having squabbles.
He's being gracious.
He is. He does that a lot. Upon our cathedral of spirit, the spire of service was firmly anchored aloft. High above its great floor, symbolizing recovery, high above those protecting walls denoting our unity, AA's spire of service rose to beckon the millions who do not yet know. The last structural job was done. Such, we think, was the inner meaning of the first General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, which met April last year in New York. And some of the subsequent shows that we've done and articles that we've been covering talked very specifically about that General Service Conference, and mm-hmm, it was historic, and it was very successful, and you can still find the recordings from that if you so choose, and listen to the talks that were given. They were unbelievably good. But great events also bore down upon us from without. Never before did so many theologians, philosophers, sociologists, employers, and political scientists approach AA to see how its principles and structures might fit into their fields of meditation and work. Never before did so many notable clergymen proclaim how the AA 12 steps could be used for almost any human problem. So they were becoming popular, and people were paying attention, and people were studying them. It's, you know, I'm sure that still happens today. It just doesn't make as big news. But there were many people who were seeing the quick rise and success of this group of ex-drunks. all of a sudden, you know, people are sending their alcoholic family members into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're getting sober, and word is spreading. So a lot of professionals started to ask questions and pay attention and come to open meetings.
Well, because prior to this, really, the only thing that we really were aware of as far as any kind of treatment was hospitals and sanitariums, right?
Yeah, there was some drying out farms. All that was a farm where there was no alcohol available, and you gotta cut hay or something.
Right.
There wasn't any real clinical, you know, expertise going on, but there was AA. There was AA going on. So there's still people around who got sober in those places.
Would you say that the Oxford group was probably the first group of people to do something other than sanitariums and take this thing seriously?
Well, the Oxford group never took alcoholics seriously. That's one of the reasons why we split off from them when we did. Bill split off sometime around 1933-34, and Dr. Bob, after the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written, you know, kind of found his way and his group's way out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Cleveland, you know, started out. Group number three started out as an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So there had been a number of places where alcoholics got sober. The earliest example that I know of that was outside of any kind of clinical or any kind of professional was the Washingtonians.
Okay.
And the Washingtonians around 1850 or 60. A bunch of people from Baltimore got sober, and word started to spread, and they formed the Washingtonian Society, and pretty soon, you know, 100,000 or more alcoholics were getting sober by fellowshipping. Okay, that's
right.
What they were doing. They were getting together, and they were committing to each other that they weren't going to drink, and we're going to stay sober, and they were, you know, they were fellowshipping.
You know why I'm laughing, don't you?
I do, because within 4 years they were all drunk. You know, because they didn't have traditions and they didn't really adhere to any spiritual course of action that was defined at all. That I've ever seen. And then there was a number of movements around the turn of the century. You know, one of them was the Salvation Army.
Sure.
They continue to be very successful. We cannot knock the Salvation Army. I've put people in there who just had no other option,
mm-hmm.
and some of them have done fine. But there was earlier religious movements, the Emmanuel movement, the Jacobi Club.
All of these were
religious organizations that got. They were basically evangelical,
faith-based,
religious organizations,
yeah.
Faith-based, sure, but they got you busy, you know. They had you doing things four or five nights a week, involved with the fellowship and with service, and many alcoholics got sober in those groups,
mm-hmm.
The Oxford group comes along, and many alcoholics got sober in the Oxford group. Bill Wilson isn't even the first alcoholic that got sober in the Oxford group to write a book about it. There's books that predate his. A couple of them are The Big Bender, For Sinners Only, I Was a Pagan. Those are all books written by Oxford group members who saw the light.
Yeah.
You know, nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous is really brand new, but the architecture has been perfected. You know what I'm saying?
Like
we don't own the spiritual principles, but we've perfected how to apply them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's sometimes there's it's God's timing and not ours, of course. And I think we as humans, we try different things and we're well-meaning and some of the ideas are good, but it's not time yet. And then God says, now it's time. And I think that's what happened with AA.
Well, I've got some experience with that kind of stuff too. Just because, you know, sometimes I come up with an idea and it just falls flat, and sometimes I come up with an idea and it works great. I think that the time and the place was right for Alcoholics Anonymous in the mid-30s. I think that was a good place for it to start. World assault upon the total alcoholic problem intensified. The noted World Health Organization became vigorous. In North America, states and provinces granted large sums to hospitals, clinics, and education. New drugs were offered as palliatives for everything that can ail an alcoholic, from his shakes to his neurosis. In all these ventures, AA invariably received high commendation. A great life insurance company in the metropolitan gave us wholesale approval in its advertising. While I don't blame them for doing that, you know, sober alcoholics tend to live longer.
Yeah.
While we could not in the least endorse any of these efforts, we did gladly cooperate with some and were grateful for all. So that's the cooperation, not affiliation, that,
gotcha.
That goes back to the beginning. And you and I have cooperated with a lot of different things over
yeah.
the years, but it's rare that we affiliate.
That's right.
Using our AA 12-step chops, you know, we're not going to affiliate. But we can be helpful. You know, C4 is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just I was talking to our friend Rick today.
Oh, neat.
He called me because he saw the Charlie P thing. And,
yeah.
You know, wanted to know what was going on, and so we talked for a while, and he updated me on where C4 Recovery Solutions is right now, and they've started a for-profit consulting business. They're helping treatment centers. You know, apply best practices.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got probably 15 consultants, and that's a for-profit. But, you know, they were putting on the symposiums. They don't do that anymore. They sold them. But they're involved in this thing called PTAC, which is, if you go to PTAC.org, you'll see exactly what they're doing. It's pushing out deflection diversion programs to police departments. And you know, we've cooperated with these people. We, you know, we volunteer as board members and try to be helpful. But I'm all for deflection and diversion because I believe alcoholism and drug addiction is an illness. It's yes, there are certain times you want to be punitive in the legal way, like with big fentanyl dealers or something.
Yeah.
But if somebody gets pulled over with a gram of coke and a bottle of wine, I don't want them getting a felony. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So these deflections and these diversion programs, what they do is they're pre-arrest. So PTAC is all pre-arrest. So, Monty, I see that you have a bottle of bourbon between your legs, an ounce of pot, and 2 grams of cocaine. Now, you know that's a felony, right? I could arrest you right now, and you would be in big trouble. How about we talk about maybe a pathway back to maybe a healthier type of living? We have some options. Would you be open to that? You know, that's really what deflection, pre-arrest deflection looks like, right?
Yeah.
And I'm all for that. And that's what C4 is gotten behind. And they're doing some amazing stuff in Jamaica too. You know, get a chance to call Rick and ask him. But that's I went off on a tangent there, but it's an example of how you and I have cooperated but not really affiliated.
Yep. Yeah, that's good.
A climax of public interest was reached in the very special February 1951 issue of the magazine Fortune. Right in the middle of this number appeared thousands of good words about AA. This piece was significantly titled "A Uniquely American Phenomenon." Its popularity has continued so great that our foundation has shipped out tens of thousands of reprints. You know, I'm not sure I'm really familiar with that one. I know the Jack Alexander article.
Right.
I know a few of the really early ones, but I'm not up to speed on this one. I'll have to track it down. The year 1951 finished in still another great blaze. The world of science, as represented by the American Public Health Association, placed upon Alcoholics Anonymous its resounding stamp of complete approval. Last October 30th, the stage of San Francisco's historic opera house was filled with leaders in medicine and notables of public life. Then and there, AA was presented with the prized Lasker Award, which in the estimate of many rates with a Nobel Prize. Not only were we recommended for our success with alcoholism, the Lasker citation actually ventured into prophecy. Its closing words declared, "Historians may one day point to Alcoholics Anonymous as a society which did far more than achieve a considerable measure of success with alcoholism and its stigma. They may recognize Alcoholics Anonymous to have been a great venture in social pioneering, which forged a new instrument for social action, a new therapy based on the kinship of common suffering, one having vast potential for the myriad other ills of mankind." Now, this is kind of prophetic, Monty. He believes that because Alcoholics Anonymous is so successful with alcoholism, this is 1951, this is before NA or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
He's seeing the writing on the wall for the application of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous applies as something that is going to show in the future to have great promise. And there's like 300 12-step fellowships, different 12-step fellowships out there now. Every 5 minutes is a new one. You know, there's chapstick Anonymous.
Yes, there is.
You know, if you're burdened with that heartbreaking obsession, you know, there's some place that you can actually go to relieve you of the terrible affliction of applying chapstick obsessively. So obsessive compulsive disorders, addiction issues, alcoholism. He was right, and again, he saw this before it was going to happen.
Yeah.
But in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the Lasker Award article is in there for anyone who wants to understand a little bit more about that. You don't hear about the Lasker Award as much as you used to. So reads the dramatic record for 1951, one of the finest yesterdays in AA history. For every AA who ponders these astonishing events will be almost sure to humbly exclaim, "What indeed hath God wrought?" Should any be tempted by the dream that AA is becoming great, powerful, or maybe destined to save the world, they could well reread the foreword to AA's tradition where these words are to be seen. If, as AA members, we can each refuse public prestige and renounce any desire for personal power, if as a movement we insist on remaining poor, if we steadfastly decline all political, sectarian, or other alliances, we shall avoid internal division and adverse public notoriety. If as a movement we remain a spiritual entity concerned only with carrying our message to fellow sufferers, then only can we most effectively complete our mission. The one thing that's just really becoming clear to me as we're going through all these articles, Monty, is how steadfast he was in his vision, how prophetic he was. He saw all of this and knew what was coming. It truly is amazing to me.
And see, this is yet another evidence to me that the hand of providence was on Bill W. Because I just don't think Bill W. I think he was a very intelligent man, but I don't think he was that smart. I think God had his hands, feet, and everything in this man.
Yeah, I believe to a degree in divine channeling. So some people become inspired.
Sure.
And through that inspiration, they can do great things, things that are above their pay grade.
Right.
And I think Bill woke up you know, on that bed in Towns Hospital, and had a complete vision. A complete vision of what his purpose in life was going to be. And something like that, I believe, only comes from the Father.
And you know what an amazing thing too, because with his history and his grandfather's, you know, disdain for religion and faith, and Bill being influenced by that, and just what he writes in Bill's story, and I think one of the things that so many people miss when they read Bill's story is what he's really saying in there. You know, it's like, hey, amen, see, Bill's just like me. He hates church and blah, blah. That's not what he's saying. He's being very transparent about his wrong thinking in the area of the spiritual and how it got corrected. And I think a lot of people miss that, unfortunately.
You know, Bill was always curious and always interested in religion. He took, he used as a spiritual advisor Father Ed Dowling,
yes,
who was a Catholic priest. He used Sam Shoemaker, who was an Episcopal minister.
Mm-hmm.
I heard the story from an old timer not long ago that he had joined a church up in Connecticut. And one day he was just talking with the pastor about Bill Wilson. And the pastor said, years and years ago, we had a member named Bill Wilson. And he looked back in the records, and sure enough, Bill had been a member of this church for a period of time in Connecticut.
Wow.
And it was a very progressive church. It was along the lines of the Christian Science, like Science of the Mind kind of church.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was just looking everywhere. He had experienced God, and I believe he was trying to better understand what that experience was. Now, Dr. Bob was more simple.
Right.
He went back to the church of his childhood and never left. You know, the day he got sober, you know, he went back, and you could find him in that pew every single Sunday. But Bill was more complicated. He asked more questions. He was more curious. But both of them went to church.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, in a big way,
yeah,
both of them did.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of church members that don't take personal instruction from priests. they just go for the invite. You know, Bill took personal instruction.
Well, you know, I love pointing out, it's one of my defects maybe, but I love pointing out to people, hey, look, there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that go to Alcoholics Anonymous and they never apply the principles in the book that is the main text of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
Just like I personally know quite a few born-again believers that attend the fellowship of their particular denomination, but seldom apply the principles in the basic text of that organization, which would be the Bible. And I'm like, you know what? We're not that different.
We must know the same people.
Yeah, right.
Again, Bill begs us to lay aside prejudice.
Yeah.
Begs us to lay aside prejudice against religion and religious people and religious principles, because there's so much value when you look at them as someone who is awake, as someone who has a proper perspective on everything. You know, my perspective was clouded with bourbon and and self-consciousness. And,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I had belief systems that were, you know, really ugly and bizarre, and not from a sane state of mind. Early on, before I had a real experience with the steps, I was very anti-religious when I first got sober. And it was because I was a late night TV watcher. and I would watch. I would watch Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, and then find out that they sold 500 Heavenly condos when they only had 250 and kept the money. and I'd see Jimmy Swaggart, who was, you know, telling everybody he's a sinner, and then getting caught with the prostitute in the Texas motel. And I was just, you know, this is hypocrisy. I may be a drop down, you know, tongue chewing, knee walking, not able to operate my own pants super drunk, but I don't rob widows. and like that's the kind of attitude I had. I used a couple of bad examples to paint the whole structure with a bad color, and that's not fair, and it's not sane, and it's not rational. Today I love the services. I love what church offers. Sure. They bury us, Monty. They marry us. They baptize us. They come to see us when we're sick.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How you gonna knock any of that? An open mind. We beg of you to lay aside prejudice and to be open to a new experience. And many of us go on to have not only recovery experiences, but religious experiences.
Sure.
And it's a wonderful thing.
So I had a religious experience, spiritual experience in 1971. And that was the year that I turned my will, my life over to Christ. And that was also the year that I discovered Christian Brothers Brandy, which I thought, you know, Christian Brothers Brandy, I'm a Christian, yeah, why not, right? And I went to Bible college because I thought I'd straighten my life out by going to Bible college, right? I was doing a lot of things that people do now. We talk about working on the symptom and not the real problem. But I was one of those guys. I became an intern. I became a youth pastor. I was an associate pastor. But I was the guy after church, me and my drinking buddy, we'd go out and get sloshed. And I think about that now, and I have a hard time, because I understand alcoholism the way I do today, I understand that. But without that understanding of alcoholism, there is no way I could wrap my head around what in the world was I thinking. I can't make sense of it until I was able to learn about what alcoholism was all about, right? Without that understanding, there is no, I get it why people and relatives and loved ones are scratching their head. I do. Because it doesn't make any sense. I was living my best life, you know, on one side of the coin and my worst on the other, and trying real hard to make them work together until everything came crashing down and I couldn't anymore. And I got called out. And I got called out in the middle of a church service. The senior pastor, it was a small church. Thank God it was a small church. The senior pastor called me up, and I thought I was closing in a song, so I brought my guitar. He goes, no, leave your guitar. I come up, I stand up in front. He puts his arm around me. Now, keep in mind, I had been approached. There's a biblical outline for this in the book of Corinthians, where I had been approached by a brother and I ignored it. I was approached by a couple of brothers and I ignored it. And finally, they brought me before the church. He puts his arm around me and he goes, Monty, everybody in this church knows that you smell like booze right now. And I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, it's over, bro.
Oh, how great.
Oh, man. And, you know, a lot of those people in that church today, we are in contact with each other. The guy that was the senior pastor, he's a good friend of mine. One of the elders of the church is one of the sponsors of one of our shows here at Take 12 Radio. And he picked up that sponsorship about 5 years ago, you know, but we hadn't seen each other in years. I mean, it's amazing stuff. But at some point in your life, I'm telling you, listeners, if you're messing around, God will call you out. It's going to happen. Either by death, you know, or, you know, that old saying, jails, institutions, and death, but you will. I got a friend, Matt, I don't know. Do you know Matt Brown?
Yes.
Interventionist. So he says, regardless of how you think what an intervention is, at some point you will be intervened upon, either by the judge, either by the wife, either by your kids, either by the pastor over your coffin, but you will experience an intervention.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I don't know if I've ever talked about this. I want to talk about it. So
okay.
So back in the mid 1800s, maybe even the early 1800s, there was a watchmaker up in Maine, and he became very, very famous for healing people. His name was Phineas Parkhurst Quimby, the watchmaker. Hmm. And people from all over the place would go up there to be healed. And he would basically heal you using the power of Christ. He called it the power of Christ, right? But when someone asked him, well, what exactly do you do with these people? Sometimes you just sit there with them. He said, I help them untangle their thoughts.
Hmm.
So he did this as kind of one of the earliest psychotherapists, but in a religious context, right?
Okay.
Now one of the people he treated and one of the people that he helped helped a lot was a woman named Mary Baker Eddy. You might know
okay,
that name.
Yeah, sure.
She started Christian Science. She wrote
yeah,
the book
Christian
on,
Science
on
book.
Christian Science. Well, somebody that Mary Baker Eddy worked with pretty closely was named Emmett Fox.
Oh, wow.
Now, here's the interesting part, Monty. Ruth Hawk, which was the secretary who was helping Bill write the book with Hank, was a big Emmett Fox fan, and she would go to Madison Square Garden when Emmett Fox would give his lectures, and guess who she brought?
Who?
Bill and Hank.
Really?
So I believe that there was a straight Christian influence from the Oxford group. Okay? It was that's basically Episcopal, right?
Yes.
Basically. And first century Christian principles in application. But this new thought, this Christian Science stuff, was also an influence on Bill. And you can see that in his writings, where he's saying the Father of Light, the great reality. He talks about God as a power. He talks about God as a verb more mm-hmm. than he talks about God as a noun.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there was these parallel influences from these two religious streams that impacted Bill. And he was able to build this recovery paradigm for us using what he'd learned in these influences.
It's amazing.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's amazing. So, see, I just love this stuff. And I just, I wish more people would get this stuff and research it and look into it. And you know, my real first exposure to dig in deeper than just the big book or the 12 and 12 was meeting Dick P. And I started reading his stuff. And I was like, what? Wow. I didn't know that. And then I'd go back to some of Bill's writings, go, yep, that's exactly what it says. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I find stuff like that. I can't help but dig deeper. It calls me to dig deeper. And that's why I refer to this stuff as rich.
So what was going on in the early meetings, if you're interested in that, Ann Smith's journal, which Dick B. published.
I have that, yes.
Is amazing. You know, she is, while Alcoholics Anonymous is formulating,
mm-hmm.
she's writing a diary and a very spiritual type of diary, and you can see her influence on some of the practices, some of the quiet time, and
yes.
And guided meditation things. So I'm interested in all this too. I used to be interested more. I did a lot more reading, you know, years ago. But I want to stay up on it because, and maybe I'm just interested in it from a selfish perspective. My life was saved by this stuff.
Yeah.
So it interests me probably
right.
more than any other intellectual endeavor. Because of that fact, I've experienced a lot of this stuff. So
yeah.
So it's interesting. So, which in effect is to pray, lead us not into temptation. Let us not be spoiled. For so long as we shall humbly meditate in this spirit upon our great yesterdays, just so long will God grant us our vision of tomorrow. More of his lofty prose. I love it when Bill stretches out with his lofty prose.
I'm sure there was probably different moments of clarity. I've had different ones, but was there a specific one in your journey that really was the brightest light that came on, the light bulb experience or whatever, if you will? Was there like one defining moment more than another?
There's been a number of them. One of them is was when a man named Joe Hawk was taking me through the steps, and I thought I understood step one. I mean, I thought I understood step one. I'm speaking everywhere. I've started a meeting.
Yeah.
I'm this hot shot, right? and Joe had me do some simple exercises that just blew up completely my conception of step one. I came out of that saying, if the power of God does not work in me and through me, I'm a dead man walking.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like a different conception of step one than I can't drink. I just can't drink because I can't take the first drink.
Right.
That's like a sophomoric kindergarten-esque version of step one.
Sure.
He broke my mind open with these exercises and had me at a complete surrender.
Wow.
So that was an experience. And another thing that blew my mind one time was a woman who's run churches and run for president and done all kinds of stuff, written great books, Marianne Williamson. Someone had asked her to do a talk on Alcoholics Anonymous's 11th step. Now, she's not an alcoholic, right? But she didn't stop her from doing a great talk on the 11th step. And she said this. She goes, people, if you're surrendering to God and you're inventorying all the things that are blocking you off from an experience with God, if you're sharing them with somebody else, if you're asking God to in a humble way to please remove those things that are blocking you off with a relationship from him. And you put a list together of the harms that you've caused that block you off from God. And you actually go out and make amends for those harms. And then you watch for this selfishness and you try to bring yourself back to God consciousness on a moment by moment basis. And then you develop prayer and meditation practices that are all about increasing the value of your relationship with God. What is God going to let get through to you that isn't in your best interest in the long run? And when she said something like that, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, my anxiety and my fear just about disappeared.
Wow.
Because what is God going to let get through to me that isn't in my best interest? I'm on God's team now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to rightly relate myself to God. And so fear left me. And that's a promise in the big book. You're not going to fear you're not going to fear the past. You're not going to fear the present. You're not going to fear the hereafter.
Right. Right.
And it happened for me in the middle of a Marianne Williamson talk. the confluence of everything that I knew, all ended up into, the one river of understanding And it, you know, I've had many spiritual experiences like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure you have too.
Yeah. So the two that really stand out to me as it relates to the 12-step process, and I may have shared this one with you before, but I had put together a binder with all sorts of graphs and graphics and everything associated with my fourth and fifth step. I mean, it was amazing, right? I mean, and it wasn't none of this cut and paste graphics. These were hand-drawn graphics. I mean, this was a piece of work, a literary genius, right? And I had it all together. I had the pages were laminated. You imagine that? My fourth step laminated, you know, it's all laminated, right? And I had it in this binder, and I marched on over to my sponsor's house, and I said, all right, I'm ready to do my fifth step. And he took one look at the binder. He didn't even open it, Chris. And he says, I have no interest whatsoever in doing this with you. You need to take this back. You need to think really hard about what you're doing. I am not talking to you tonight. And he sent me on my way. And I went the little park where we had meetings down in the Girl Scout hut, and this little park was right down from his house. And I sat there defeated. I was just so defeated. My ego had been just ripped to shreds. And I'm sitting there, and I literally started talking to God, and I said, what am I supposed to do? You know? And I kept getting this still small voice, not that. And you know, so eventually I ended up taking my fifth step with a drunk, actually, but my sponsor and I we kind of mended ways. Or I mean, he hadn't done anything wrong. He knew what he was doing. And I kind of came back, and he said, so what are we doing? I go, let's do it the way the book says to do it. And he goes, there you go. You know, and so we had a lot of laughs about that, but that was a real, that really showed me how self-centered I was, even in my recovery. And you know that part where it talks about, you know, even in our best moments, you know, we can be generous and kind and all, but it's all manipulation. And that's exactly what was going on. The other one was I had lost my sponsor, the same guy. He had relapsed after 7 years, and he was in a world of hurt. And I had asked this guy to be my temporary sponsor, and he was kind of a rough guy. And I was whining to him about these people in my life and blah, 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 blah. And he just looks at me, and he slapped me in the face. Not hard. He just kind of like a love slap, you know? Kind of like the Godfather, you know, doing it.
a zen slap.
Yeah. And he goes, when are you going to get it through your thick skull that you are powerless over other people's choices? And it was like daylight in the middle of night just came on. What a concept. You know, he says you can encourage, you can discourage, you can influence. Bottom line, their decision is their decision. And that's just where you got to leave it. And I was like, wow. And something happened to me because, Chris, I was so, talk about emotional dependency versus emotional sobriety. I was so emotionally dependent on other people. It was crippling. I mean, I look back at it now, and I am amazed that I lived to see my 30th birthday. That's how serious it was. And when that guy told me that, everything changed. Everything changed for me. It was like this horrible weight of armor was just removed from me, you know. And all this stuff happened within the workings of my 12-step directions and guidance, you know. It's amazing stuff.
So we have many spiritual experiences that contribute to our eventual spiritual awakening.
Yeah,
that's what I believe. And if you start to have them, if you know you're experiencing these, you're on the right path.
Yeah, you are.
You know?
Yeah. Later in years, my sponsor Bruce, who passed away here not long ago, he used to say, "This is the most marvelous thing that's ever happened to me. You don't want to miss it." And I wholeheartedly agree.
I agree.
All right, my friend.
I'm with you.
So next week, our final great decision. Okay. I'm going to be tempted to read it, but I'm not going to. We're going to save it for next week. Listeners, this has been a great show. Thanks for tuning in. Chris, thank you so much.
I love being here, Monty.
All right, my friends. Okay. Our email is take12radio@comcast.net. Please drop us a line and listen to the little blurb at the end of the show to tell you how to listen to other workshops that we have as well. So until our next broadcast, this is the Monty Man along with Chris S., and we are wishing God's perfect serenity for you. For more recovery workshops with Chris S. and the Monty Man, visit our website at take12radio.com and click on the Recovery Workshops banner.
This has been a broadcast of Take 12 Recovery Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.
Kitty, 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 kitty. Meow, meow, meow.
Woof.